Hello and welcome to Affable Chat. My name is Benjamin and this is my co-host Joey.
Hey, how's it going?
And today we're joined by two special guests. Our first guest is your bracket master, Jay. Jay, welcome to Affable Chat.
Thank you so much for having me.
And our other guest is a grouchy sandworm who's had one too many Fremen throw a grappling hook into his skin and is going to lose it, Elias Stokes. Eli, welcome back to Affable Chat.
Look, I know public transit is big, but can you lay off the hooks a little bit?
And we brought them here today because we're discussing Dune Part 2.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes, then great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
This is an epic action-adventure science fiction political thriller.
Directed by Denis Villeneuve.
The cast includes Timothée Chalamet, Michi, Amy March, Ilsa Faust, Simone, Baron Skarsgård of House Skarsgård, live-action King Triton, subscribe to Duke Cody, Southern Strategy Elvis, battle-damaged White Grape Thanos, and Fatboy Slim's uncredited businessman.
I watched this movie at a Regal cinema. Jay, how did you watch this movie?
I watched this at my own regional theater chain, Marcus Theaters.
Nice. Eli, how did you see it?
I wrote on the big screen with an exclamation point, but it was the same chain Jay went to, Marcus Theaters.
Yeah, we know.
Big screen, though.
And Joey, how about you?
I watched it also in theaters, but I didn't realize this when I signed up for this. I thought I was going to see it on like a semi-IMAX theater. I picked the 4DX option, which turns out meant like 4D movie. Like my seats moved and they blew wind and like
no.
Air and stuff was shooting past me. Yeah, it was crazy.
Whoa.
I had no idea. I went there with my friend Kevin and we sat down in the chairs and we're like, these chairs are weird. And there's little buttons on the side that said like water on, water off. I'm like, what does that mean? And then they have this thing that's like, you're sitting in 4DX. And it was like a fake trailer for like a fake action movie. And then they shot, you know, the seats moved around and the air was blowing on you. And they had like, there's like little things in the seats that like kick you in the back. Like Kevin, during the knife scene, there's like a little thing that pokes you right in the back, and
you're
Kevin
kidding.
Turned around because he thought someone was like touching his shoulder.
Oh my god!
It was wild. Halfway through, I'm like, I'm so glad I didn't buy popcorn because it would just like spilled everywhere. So I was being shit so much. It was some parts were really cool, and other parts were really silly. Like when they're doing the big action scenes where like they're like in the middle of the fights, you know, they have like the classic like battle, the armies battling, it's like really like intense, the seats like rumbling and moving and stuff, and then they do the wide shot and everything goes still and you're like, and then it goes back to, then it cuts back to like the scene inside and like, rumbling again. It's like, okay, I think you need some sort of compromise there, but it was crazy. I don't know if I would have done it on purpose or if I'll do it again, but it was definitely a great experience when I did it. So.
That's awesome. Do you guys, have you guys heard anybody say that you're not experiencing it if you're not going to IMAX? Have you heard any of these IMAX elitists?
A little bit. I mean,
a little
I feel
bit,
like some
yeah,
people,
yeah.
I feel like some people have said like, oh, I'm so going to see an IMAX. And I'm like, should I?
I love IMAX. I just don't have access to a good IMAX theater. The IMAX theater here is terrible, so I just went and saw it at a regular theater. I thought it was great. This is a big screen movie, so I think as long as you're seeing it in the theater, you know, within reason, that's probably the way it was intended to be seen. Okay, well, before we begin our analysis of this film, we will succinctly summarize the events in our special 60-second synopsis. If you'd like to skip the synopsis, just scrub ahead 60 seconds right now.
Despite the machinations of the Emperor, Paul Atreides is still alive. He lives among the Fremen, learning their ways, gaining their respect, and falling in love with their women, specifically a Fremen named Chani.
Led by Paul, the Fremen disrupt Harkonnen spice operations throughout Arrakis, giving fuel to the rumor that he is the Lisan al-Ghaib, the voice from the outer world. The Lisan al-Ghaib is a messiah-like figure who is prophesied to bring paradise to Arrakis.
Paul's mother, Jessica, takes on the role of Reverend Mother and drinks from the Water of Life. This gives her and her unborn child strange abilities. Jessica pressures Paul to embrace his role as Lisan al-Ghaib, but Paul's new spice-rich diet is giving him visions of a terrible future. His dreams will lead to a holy war that grips all of human civilization.
Baron Harkonnen replaces one nephew with another. This new nephew is Fade Rotha, and he begins the systematic extermination of the Fremen.
After drinking from the Water of Life himself, Paul embraces his prescribed destiny and starts his holy war. He threatens to blow up Arrakis unless the Emperor himself intervenes.
When the Emperor arrives, Paul outmaneuvers his army and challenges him for the throne. The Emperor chooses Fade Rotha as his champion, and Paul and Fade Rotha knife fight to the death. Paul kills Fade and claims the Emperor's daughter's hand, ensuing his ascendancy and the terrible events in his visions.
The end.
There you have it. The events of Dune Part 2. We'll begin our discussion by going over our pros and cons. And I'll start with you, Jay. What did you like about Dune Part 2?
So there's definitely a lot to like about this movie. I was listening to the last episode that we did on Dune 1 on Affable Chat, and a lot of my pros, I realized, were the same. were the same as what I liked about the first part is what I liked about the second part, so I'll refrain from mentioning those and try to focus on the second movie here, but you do have to appreciate that this movie continues to escalate the epic scale. This movie continues to envelop you in the narrative, and it never lets go. It makes full use of its runtime. The battles are incredible. They have amazing scale. I don't think I could be there as much as Joey was there, but as much as in a normal theater, I felt like I was there in the battles. And the worms are freaking incredible, like some of the best like special effects creatures I've ever seen. And I really love the scale and epicness of this movie. I really enjoyed the characters more in this movie than I did the first part. I felt like everybody had a part to play, pushing Paul in one direction or another. I love it when like a protagonist sort of starts taking on these different aspects of the people around them. You know, everyone around them is sort of pushing them one direction or another, and they start to learn lessons, they start to take advice, and eventually they come to their own conclusions about the world. That and every character was portrayed incredibly. I thought all the acting was spot on. And I want to give particular props to Timothée Chalamet for Paul's shift from just being this special boy to God. so, you know, I felt that shift in him when he finally, like, his mind fully opened up and he could see everything. And then I did feel like this movie brought part one and part two brought to a satisfying conclusion for the planet of Arrakis. You know, I felt like, you know, we got to a pretty satisfying conclusion from these duo of movies.
Okay. We'll send it over to Eli. Eli, what did you like about Dune Part Two?
So I'm sure I'm going to be repeating a lot of things in Dune Part 1 review, as Jay said, but I kind of just want to echo what you were saying, Jay, about the epicness. I love the scale of this movie because it wasn't just the battles that felt bigger. It felt like every facet of the first Dune movie, Villeneuve really like amped it up. And I mean like everything. Just I love the like shots of Arrakis. They feel so much bigger than in the first movie. I love the like all the lore. You know, there's so much more lore here. It just feels like every, you know, minute detail was cranked up to 11, and it just felt like it. I feel like it earned that part two. It wasn't just a retread of Dune Part One, but like really amplified it and made it bigger. Speaking of lore, I think that was one of my favorite parts of the movie was we got to get off Arrakis and got to see the world, the whole galaxy rather, at play. We got to see Yeah, we got to see the stark yet gorgeous home planet of the Harkonnens Gedi Prime, and just how austere and horribly beautiful that planet is compared to Arrakis. We got to see the Emperor and Irulan politicking with the Bene Gesserit that gave the whole like new realm of, you know, intrigue going on behind the scenes, which is very cool. It just gave us it. Like, Dune is such a massive universe, and Villeneuve, I feel, really understands that and wants to communicate that. This isn't just, you know, Arrakis, even though it is Arrakis is so important, but there's more things going on, and I thought he did a great job of communicating that. And, I mean, it goes to say with pretty much any Villeneuve project, just all the technical elements of the movie are astounding. As Jay mentioned, the acting is great. The directing, cinematography, music, effects, editing, choreography, you know, it was just everything about it. I couldn't think of one thing. I was just like, that could have been better. It to me, it's such a treat when you see a bunch of talented people come together and make something really cool. And Dune Part 2, as well as the first movie, feel like they fall into that category. And, you know, at some point, my brain just gave up on deep analysis. Like, at some point in the movie, my brain stopped trying to, like, figure things out and just... I just let the movie, like, take over. I just sat back. I let myself be enveloped in this world. And after I saw the movie, I messaged a friend and he asked me how it was. And I said, I can't accurately describe how I'm feeling, except Dune was freaking cool. And that's just, it's just cool. Like, I don't need to like, you know, there's that part of you that the childlike wonder that this movie really tapped into. And I really appreciate that.
Okay, we'll pass it over to Joey next. What did you like about Dune Part 2?
I echo a lot of what you guys have just said and what I've said in the past too. I think epic is really the best word to describe this. And thinking about this, I can't imagine a better medium than the big screen for this story. It's incredible. The use of color is magnificent. I even though it's like all very drab, and like it's all grays and sometimes just black and white and sometimes just like sand color. I love the contrast with the Fremen and the Emperor and the Sardaukar and all of that. It's so wonderful. I feel like it lives up to its hype that was built up in the first one, and it's so much more than that. There's all these iconic moments that are finally faithfully brought to the big screen, and I think are totally upheld by just amazing practical effects and awe-inspiring performances. I liked it when it stayed true to the story, and I liked it when it deviated from the story. This whole thing of plans within plans is a big motif within Dune, and there's so much depth and richness to the story, and the movie captures a lot of it, which I really appreciated. And it didn't shy away from any of the weird stuff either. The fact that Lady Jessica's talking to her fetus is like what are some of the like iconic things. I'm so glad that's in there. I freaking love that. I think all of this is what Dune should be, and I'm just tickled and so satisfied with what they were able to bring to the screen. What about you, Benjamin?
I again echo a lot of the same sentiments as you guys. I have to say the word epic. It truly is epic.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every character looms so large. It makes me feel familiar with these characters. I've been missing out on this landmark in science fiction all this time. And after watching Dune Part 2, I'm like, I'm in now. I get this now. I understand why people know these characters so well. And I have an idea of how much depth there is to so many of them. Fade Rotha doesn't even show up till like halfway through the film, but I felt like they built him up so well and gave us that rival to Paul that it's like, wow, how did I not know who this guy was when I walked into this theater and he ends up being so important here? Just in beyond that, just addictive world building. This movie made me fall in love with Dune and the fictional world around Dune. I want to know more about everything. And so I thought that was really great. I also love this idea of progressively figuring out who is him, you know, going like the last movie, they keep telling us Paul is him, but then, you know, Fade Rotha is him, but the reigning him right now is the Emperor. So we get to see him get, you know, taken down. So it's, I loved it. The stakes kept rising. Everybody's just more and more badass as the story goes on. I thought that was awesome. I love Stilgar. And watching him watch the prophecy come true was so much fun. I've heard other people come out of the movie and they're like, as is written, you know, his reactions to everything come true. It was funny, but also it was powerful. You saw his faith. You saw that moment of revelation when the things that he'd believed in came true. It was very awesome. mind-blowing spectacle. Just things that made your jaw drop. I like the way that Eli put it. There, at a certain point, you're just like, just take me for a ride. I'm not even, like, this movie is just going to take me there. It's hard to pick a favorite scene, honestly, because there are so many moments where you're like, oh my goodness. And I think that's because this movie's capitalizing on the stage set from the first film. I think Dune 1, in comparison, seems a lot slower, seems like a lot less happens, but it's so important that they took their time with that so that the second part can just be almost all payoff. And at least it felt like almost all payoff to me. So many layers to this film. There's so much to dig your teeth into after and think about. Religion, war, love, motherhood, revenge. So many things. These dynasties that you can, you know, have a discussion about. And it's so easy to recognize the mammoth influence of Dune after you've actually seen Dune. Because there's so many moments where I was like, that's like just from, that's from Star Wars. And then I'm like, hold on a second. Star Wars took it from this.
Which Sand is just planet. Awesome. Wait, what?
All right. So those are our pros. Lots of pros. But maybe we didn't like everything. So what are our cons for Dune Part 2? We'll start with Eli.
Yeah, so Benjamin, you talk about Fayed Rotha, and he was also one of my favorite parts of the movie, which lends into my first con. I wanted more Fayed Rotha. specifically, I don't want to make this sound like, oh, he was so great, there should have been more of him. I really wish they introduced him sooner, because the movie really wants us to have this, like you said, the rivalry between him and Paul. He's like the inverse of Paul, the evil version. But I feel like that plot line would have been so much more palpable if we saw him growing along with Paul. Maybe the first, like, when Paul's experiencing his life with the Fremen, cut to scenes of Fayed Rotha on Gedi Prime or something, talking to the Baron. I think there could have been a much more earned, like, that plotline could have been much more earned than showing up. I mean, the fact he shows up halfway in the movie, like you said, is a tremendous work of, like, acting from Austin Butler and filmmaking from Villeneuve, but it was, like, it could have been so much better. Like, it could have, like, amped up so much more, and yeah, it again, it's just like, it was so great for what we had, and we could have had more, you know? And that's along with my other complaints of the movie, similar to the first movie. I just wanted more. Why, Villeneuve, why do you not make these things 3.5 hours long? I wish you would. Because, like, as much as I love the lore, I wish we got more. There was so much stuff left on the cutting room floor from the book. Things like the Spacing Guild, the Mentats, you know, they weren't even, Thufir Hawat, you know, he wasn't in the movie either. Yeah, and like an actual appearance from Alia. That was the character I was looking forward to most. I wanted to see weird little girl going around stabbing people, but we didn't get that. And like, I understand these things don't take away from Dune Part 2 in isolation, but it's just frustrating for me knowing what we could have had. Like, same thing with the first Dune. Just please, just give me the Lord of the Rings uncut 8-hour version of the movies. Like, I think most people would be fine with it. But and echoing that same thing, a lot of the characters, a lot of the side characters were great, similar to Fayed Rotha, but they kind of felt more like additions than like pillars the movie is built upon. Characters like Raban, Irulan, Margot, even Gurney to an extent, like at the conclusion when he finally got his, it was kind of like, I don't know, it kind of felt like a side quest almost. Similar to the first Dune movie and my complaints with that, giving it so much more time to breathe, giving these characters more subtle moments. I was talking to a friend and he was really disappointed in Raban because really he just got his shit kicked in the movie.
Yeah.
didn't do a whole lot. And yeah, it was just like Irulan was like a narrator. Margot was, she just, you know, did some Bene Gesserit stuff. Yeah, I again, please, like, why do you not make these movies just even longer? I want more.
All right, well, let's pass it over to Jay. What did you not like about Dune Part 2?
One thing I in reference to Eli's comment there, we talked a lot about in Dune Part 1 Affable Chat, how we were looking forward to the director's cut of Dune, and it didn't happen. It doesn't exist. And I'm just so disappointed. And I looked it up. I was like, did I miss this somehow? But there's like quotes from Denis Villeneuve saying, nope, that's it. You got what you got. And we're not getting anything else. And even in reference to part two, he's like, I made the movie I made. You're not even going to see deleted scenes from this thing, man. So, like, get, you know, like, get satisfied with what you have, which is a bummer. You know, art is art or whatever. I don't know. So for my cons, I'll build up to like my biggest con here, but my first con is the Emperor. I was excited to see Walken in this role, and then they didn't give me full Walken. I felt like he sort of had this leash on him. Like there was like moments where I was gonna get full Christopher Walken, and then all of a sudden like he wasn't there. And I wanted like I just wanted more of him, and like similar to that, you know, just the Emperor's world in general, it seems like it's just Christopher Walken, the princess, and sometimes the Bene Gesserit are there. Yep. And that's it. That's the whole world. Like, we don't see a not even a single panning clip of like a city or something that they live in. It's just them, which maybe is intentional, you know, but it does make that world, and in general, all the worlds just sort of feel empty. The worlds themselves are great, but you know, it's even when you do get to see people, which is on the Harkonnen homeworld, you know, you get to see the full stadium full of people, but then, you know, they're all just, you know, they're literally whitewashed, you know, like, you know, you know, so like you don't actually get to like they're just all painted as every person on this world is a Harkonnen. They're all bloodthirsty. They're all bad. You know, it just doesn't feel like a true universe necessarily. And for my last con, this is going to sound really harsh, but I promise, I really did like this movie.
But it's okay, Jay. We're not going to hurt you.
I've sort of felt like this movie didn't have a heart to it. It was sort of soulless to me. The movie is really, it's really cool. It's epic. It's incredible on so many fronts. But I literally have zero emotional attachment to this movie. Even the quiet moments between our leads, which I think are genuinely well acted, don't provoke any feeling or emotion in me whatsoever. There's just no way I could connect to Paul. I can connect to some of the side characters like Gurney, you know, but just because like I feel like the anger, you know, and I can feel that, you know, these characters, they want something in this world, or they want something better for this world, and I can understand that, but I don't feel it necessarily, you know. And maybe I've considered that this is just like how I'm feeling about this movie at this particular time, and maybe I'll look at it differently when on a rewatch, but even in the epic scale of this movie, I just didn't feel very much. It didn't provoke a lot of emotion in me.
I agree with you, Jay. I think there's a lot of stuff that's missing from this that's present in other well-built worlds. And I think it stems back to the source material. We're talking about, you know, the game pieces we're talking about here are entire worlds that are homogeneous, you know, and or a city on that world, right? And then these big players, which are the you know, the houses, right? You don't get hardly any time with any normal people in the Dune universe, right? Mm-hmm. It's always this epic political struggle, right? That's something that movies do a really good job of showing those like quick moments of like people living their lives, and like that gives so much like depth and like you know, it gives so much character to the world. That's what Star Wars has like always been so celebrated for, is all the background stuff, you know, all the little pieces, all the little tiny little things that lead to making up a great tapestry. Whereas Dune is kind of empty of that, except for the stuff that it's focusing on, right? And I think it's hard to do that in a book like this, but in a movie, it's much easier. But I think that Denis Villeneuve was really focused on trying to adapt the book into a movie. And I think that there is some detriments to that, which is part of some of my cons. I think he had a choice between trying to make this story accessible or very adherent to the original text. Because the reason why Dune is not as popular as something like Star Wars or even Lord of the Rings is because it's too damn complicated. It's very esoteric. There's so much stuff going on, and I think it's amazing. It scratches my itch, like what I want from science fiction, perfectly. But it's not for everyone. And I think that by adhering to the original text in that way, he's setting up these movies to fall into that same hole of not being as popular or as accessible as these other like tent poles of science fiction, because he wants it to be just like the book, and the book is hard to understand, hard to get into. We talked about this many times, you know, on pod and off pod, about how the first 100 pages of Dune is just like a slog because it's so hard to understand what's going on. You know, you need some sort of primer. You need to watch the movie first, or you need someone to explain it to you before you can get into it, because it's so hard to get it in there. So, I think that's kind of a, I don't know if it's a missed opportunity or if it, like, it's a stylistic choice or what, but it certainly seems like we're going to run into a pattern here of Dune being adapted well and then kind of pushed to the side because people don't want to engage with it at the level that's asking you to engage with it at.
Well, I think to build off what you're saying, Dune was famously like the unadaptable movie.
Yes.
Like, if you ever heard of what's his name, Hodorowski, they made a whole documentary about his failed attempt to make Dune. So this has been an infamous series to adapt. And yeah, I think you're totally right. It's so esoteric, so strange. I think the books, too, what lends themselves hard to like screen adaptations, they're so cerebral. So much of the movie, or so much of the book, is people thinking, those plots within plots you were talking about. And so, yeah, the fact Villeneuve has been able to have done what he's done with the source material is commendable, but you're right. There's just something lost when you have such a cerebral story communicated into the grand epic sci-fi adventure.
It's the cerebralness and it's the freaking sand. You know, like, there's so much, it's all dunes. It's all freaking just a bunch of, like, the sandworms are freaking awesome, right? But, like, that's the only facet of non-homogeneousness of Arrakis, you know?
Do you think the first movie
hard to just look at a bunch of sand and be like, oh, this is interesting. You know?
Do you think they should have made the first movie Dune and the sequel Dunes?
Two Dune, Two Furious. I have one other complaint, and that's the PG-13 rating. I think that we lose out on some of the visceralness, some of the, some of the violence, some of the, gripping and weird nature of what this story is, because it's shying away and making it into like a more ironically accessible movie by putting it down to that PG-13 rating. I do feel like there are like some blood spurts and people's like necks being cut and stuff, but it's all very tame, you know. And even those like feudalistic fight scenes kind of are bloodless, and you know, between faceless characters fighting each other, so you don't have that opportunity for quite that much weirdness. And if I was making Dune, I would have gone hard R, as they say.
Yeah, they definitely say that. all right, so some of my cons. I needed subtitles. I saw this movie twice, and there's still dialogue that I missed, unfortunately. I feel like I tend towards the side of needing subtitles anyways, but like, for instance, do you guys know what Fade Rotha said to that last guy that he killed in the arena? He like stabs him, and he says something, Atreides, but I don't know what he said. And I feel bad that I missed it twice.
I think retroactively he might say, "You fought well, Atreides," which will be echoed later.
I think
you're right. I didn't even think about it, but yeah, I wasn't sure what he said. Well, everybody's just so close and talking in this like loud whispers.
But it's one of those things that I feel like makes sense coming out of a book. It's where it's like you don't necessarily need to hear those things in the action, but if you can read what they say and you're like, oh, I actually, that's meaningful, and I miss out on all that stuff. I don't know if that's really a con, but we'll definitely watch this again when it comes out on streaming with subtitles. I echo, the call for more from the Empire. I actually, as much as I, or the Emperor in his world, as much as I thought it was cool that it was Christopher Walken, and this whole time they've been building up the Emperor. We didn't really get to see any of that, so it felt like Paul defeating him was kind of like, yeah, I mean, who is this, like, chump, right? Like, it's supposed to be, whoa, Paul just did what it can't be done because he, you know, the Fremen make him that much more powerful, but it almost just seemed inevitable and less epic because we didn't get to see why the Emperor is so highly regarded. It was just told to us as opposed to shown. Like, I don't know enough about the Sardaukar, and maybe I missed this, but they're not his citizens, right? They're just his army. Like, what are his citizens like? Who, you know, like, who are the Atreides, like, people or, you know, equivalent for the Emperor? I wish we could have seen that.
It's not even mentioned in the movie, but the Emperor is from a great house. He's from House Carino, but that's not even mentioned.
Right. Which feels like a huge missed opportunity. And kind of what you guys said as well, just exploring each individual world a little bit more, it does feel like it's, you know, main character with NPC, like, you know, civilization that they rule over. One of the things I've been discovering as I've read the book is the ways that these leaders are able to influence their societies. Leto Atreides is really good at propaganda, and I know they can't put everything from the book in the movies, but I thought that was a really cool thing to comment on. It would be interesting to compare those things across the different societies. So, you know, I kind of wish we had a little bit more of that. Also, was anybody else confused with the way that Paul won the knife fight with Fade Rotha? When I first saw it, I was like, because I'd never read Dune, I was like, wow, I can't believe Paul dies at the end of part two. Like, he's dead. I just watched him get stabbed and then stabbed again. I thought his fingers were going to fall off with he was getting, like, holding the blade.
Oh, yeah, the way he's holding the knife. Yeah.
And then, and the second time I watched it, I was like, okay, it makes a little more sense now because I'm like looking for it. But even then, he just kind of walks it off. Like, the stab wounds meant nothing. So I don't know. Was anybody else taken aback by that?
I don't know if I was taken aback by it. I just kind of, like, I guess thinking about it, I'm just like, well, it's just some Bene Gesserit bullshit. You know, like, I don't know, like, he can like send the blood away from his wounds to, like, where it matters and, like, seal the wounds through concentration or something.
Or he's so hopped up on spice he can't feel pain.
There you go. Yeah.
Just like, yeah, just the adrenaline takes you through. I'm the Emperor now. That's pretty good high, you know.
You can see for that. Can we talk about, I don't know, Paul, it's like, I don't know how to call it, but proposing to a girl in front of your girlfriend, like, that's
wait, Reddit, am I the asshole for proposing to the princess in front of my girlfriend?
I said I loved her for as long as I'm breathing. I don't think that should be. I won't spoil it, but that's actually a scene at the end of the book, Benjamin, that I think I would be interested about hearing your opinion, because that actually gets touched on.
Well, I'm excited to get further into the book, but for now, let's stay on the movie, and I'm going to pass it over to Joey to send us to our overall section.
Okay. Obviously, I had to bring you guys back for the sequel. I don't want to just kind of go over a lot of the same things we went over last time, like your Dune experiences. If you are interested in Eli, Jay, and my Dune experiences, you can go listen to our part one episode, which is almost as long as the movie.
Almost. The director's cut is longer than the movie.
So I'm gonna skip down to this one. So what does this movie, how does this movie speak to you personally, specifically the part two, like, aspects of it? I'll start with you, Eli.
It's so interesting, Jay, because I kind of echoed how what you said about the movie kind of having, like, soulless, not really connecting with me. But I felt that with the first movie and reading the book. Dune part two, I felt so much more emotionally invested. I'm trying to figure out why. But I think, what about this movie speaks to me personally? I love movies that capture the true danger of power. You see this a lot with, I know we keep using the word epic, but the actual epic movie genre, which was so popular in, like, the 50s, just giant scale, but it's, like, cool, but also not, you know, like, Dune Part Two does an excellent job of showing Paul's struggle, not just with gaining power, but the struggle of wanting it. There's a quote, can't remember what they say exactly, but Gurney's talking to Paul, and Paul says, "I'm scared of power," oh, are you scared of losing it? And Paul's like, no, of getting it. And you see that struggle throughout the movie. It's just his, like, you know, people are just like, you got to go down south. And he's like, no, if I go down south, like, shit will go south, you know? but I think Villeneuve does such a great job of showing Paul's ascension, being reluctant to be the Messiah figure. And at the climax, you know, it's exciting. You know, they're waving the Atreides flag on the sandworms and sieging Arrakeen. But there's kind of this feeling of like, oh, this probably isn't good.
Right.
And I really connected with Paul more so than I've ever done in the book or the previous movie of him just... It clearly wants, he loves hanging out with the Fremen. Like, my favorite part of the movie was those first, like, the first, like, 40 minutes of him just assimilating into the culture. And he seems like he's having a genuinely good time, but there's just this feeling of, like, this can't last. And I just, it breaks my heart at the end when he's, like, telling Shani, like, you know, I'll love you as long as I breathe. But he's clearly, like, I need to do this. Like, if in a perfect world, he would just stay with the Fremen and not be Lisan al Gaib. But just, I don't know, it just hurt my heart seeing it. Seeing it all, like seeing this fun hanging out at the desert camps, drinking coffee or whatever. That's all in the past now. Now he's the prophet. Now he's leading the jihad. And it's just like, man, I want to go back. and I think the movie does a great job of showing that dangerous sense of power. I mean, the first line, the narrator in that cool ass Sardaukar beatboxing voice says spice is power overall. And you see that. It's just like people, the humanity gets stripped away when power is involved. And the movie does a great job of communicating that.
What do you make of the quote? I feel like it comes in the book a bunch of times, but they do say it in the movie that... The power to destroy something is the power to, it's like, means that you control it, or like, it's like the true power means you have the ability to destroy a thing.
Yeah, I think you say that quote when they find the cache of nuclear weapons.
Yeah,
maybe. Mm. And that's just such a, I mean, it's a baller line, first of all, but I mean, thematically, it is true. Like you have the power to create, because the alternative is we destroy this, and it's just, I think. I mean, given the political climate of, like, the world at the moment, I feel like we have that sense, too, of, like, this is all, like, these powers that be can just as quickly destroy everything that's been built up as much as, like, grow forward. So, I don't know. And I think spice is just the, like, the physical manifestation of that power. I think that's Definitely. Where that quote of, like, spice is power.
It's the bottleneck, right, for their society. Yeah. I don't know. It's always struck me as very negative, right? And, like... Power might be a thing that's not like a good thing to for people to have necessarily. I don't know, but it's certainly a thing that exists. And to consider it only in terms of what it can destroy makes me feel like it's a very negative outlook on what this strange thing is. I don't know. I tend to agree with Dune on this aspect. Seems to know a lot about power, but it's also like a, I don't know, it makes me wonder if there's something to be questioned there.
I also want to highlight something I don't think the movie communicated really well, and Benjamin, you can like tell me since you haven't read the book, but do you know why the universe needs spice?
For interplanetary travel. That was...
Okay, I could not remember if that was communicated well enough, but not in the book. But in the David Lynch movie, the 80s version, you actually meet one of the navigators who used this spice. And that, I'm not going to spoil what it looks like, but they don't look good. and it's like you see like the physical like corruption of the power, because that's what spice does to people. And it, yeah. And like, but you're right, Joey, like spice, as much as it has expanded the galaxy and enabled people to like travel beyond their imagination, it just as much as like destroy, like, I mean, you watch the movie, everything's getting blown up over the cinnamon melange.
What about you, Jay? Did anything speak to you personally?
So, I mean, as stated, it didn't do a lot for me personally. And I think to reference your Eli, I also think it's interesting that like I connected more with the first movie, and you're sort of on the opposite end of this, like connecting more with the second movie. And I was thinking about that, and I feel like maybe in the first movie, I was just happy to be here. You know, I was just like happy that this existed. And I was also very fresh off of finishing the book as well. And I haven't touched the book since then either. Right. And so I think a little bit like the awe has worn off a little bit. And I felt myself, well, actually, this is sort of a question for later, like references to other pop culture, but I'll give a little teaser now, I guess. I really want this movie to feel, or, and not intentionally, but I've wanted it to feel like the Lord of the Rings. I want this to be Lord of the Rings, but sci-fi. And it's not that at all. I mean, it is that a little bit, but not to the degree that I think my some deep part of my brain wants it to be. But again, we'll circle back to that a little bit later. But as far as things that did speak to me personally, I always appreciate the scale of things, not just as in like literally what's in front of me right now, but I was thinking about this and I've always been interested in like the long-term effects of religion on human history, and the scale of which the Bene Gesserit must have been like planting the seeds of this prophecy in the Fremen is crazy to me. You know, like thinking about them, I mean, it must have been generations of them like planting these seeds for them to be called the fundamentalists. You know, that is a long, long time that they've anticipated Paul or someone like Paul coming. And then I was thinking about, well, if this is true on Arrakis, how many other planets in the galaxy are there just untold, like, prophecies that will never come true because Paul went to Arrakis instead, you know? And so I really enjoy, like, thinking about, like, the scale of time in this movie, too.
Yeah, and to add on to that, I think this was part of the book, either that or the first movie, but they talked about how they set these religions up, the Bene Gesserit do, in case they need them. So it's almost like a break glass in case of like Messiah, you know, because they go to these planets, plant the Bene Gesserit there as like the leaders of the religion, and then set up a situation where they can basically grab onto the steering wheel for that culture and say, okay, the chosen one that you guys have been waiting for is finally here. But what's interesting to me is that even though the chosen one that Paul is, like the Lisan al-Ghaib, is just made up by the Bene Gesserit, the Kwazak Hadarak is not made up, supposedly. The Bene Gesserit are like, no, this is the chosen one we actually have to bring about. And it makes you wonder, it's like, is the Lisan al-Ghaib just like a, you know, part of being the Kwazak Hadarak? Like, maybe they made it up, but it's just a parallel to the thing that Bene Gesserit actually believe. And if the Bene Gesserit one is made up, who made that one up?
well, like, yeah, it's all plans all the way down. But I'm I'm curious what you guys think, because I had this thought after seeing the movie when the Reverend Mother, Charlotte Rampling's character, I can't remember, Gaius, you know, the old scary lady, when she
was old scary,
when she was telling Jessica, or no, I can't remember who she was talking about, actually. No, they were planning for Fade Rautha to be the replacement. Do you think that she knew that Paul was the Kwisatz Haderach and was scared? Because, like, if he's the Kwisatz Haderach, and she loses all her power, everything that the Bene Gesserit have built for, yeah, they reached this point, but everything changes because of that. And I was talking to my friend about that. I'm curious how you guys feel about that.
So remember, Paul was not supposed to be a boy.
Yeah, oh, that's right, yeah.
Jessica gave Leto a son, an heir, even though she was instructed to birth like a girl. And that threw off the calculations and possibly brought about the Kwisatz Haderach a generation earlier than it was supposed to. And therefore, right, all of the other things, all of these things that the Bene Gesserit are doing are kind of what's the word?
Damage
they're recovering almost. Yeah, they're like I can't, there's a term for it, now it's I'm
blanking insurance
on
policy.
Yes, basically. It's a backup plan, right? They're trying to recover from this, you know, this decision that Jessica made, and they have all these other plans, they have all these other avenues to get what they want, right?
Contingencies
and all the contingencies, thank you. It's all these different plans that go all the way down. If you're planning something for thousands and thousands of generations, perhaps you build in some backups, you know, automatically, just as a plan. Yeah, Jay, I agree with you. Like, the long-term thinking and like the like the effects of like religion and all of that, I think is so interesting. I love Dune for its treatises on human potential and the failings of that, right? Given all of this, all the opportunities that Paul has, given all of the different things that the Bene Gesserit have planned for, and he still succumbs to revenge. He still acts because he wants to, because he's sad his dad died, you know? He can't, for some reason, that can't be overcome. For some reason, that's so innate in the human psyche that you can never, no matter what you do, like bypass that. And he's still susceptible to the whims of other people, of his mom, of his mentor. He's still, he still gets intoxicated by the power that's given to him, despite literally knowing better, right? Despite being able to see the future, he still finds a way. He still goes back to his lizard or human instincts. And I think it's amazing contrasting these two things, showing what it might be possible, right? Given what we know about psychology today, and then saying that's not enough. It's our human behaviors are still so innate they cannot be overcome. I think that's beautiful, wonderful, incredible.
Yeah, cool. And that's why I wish the movie talked a little bit more or discussed a little bit more the mentats and the doctors, you know, the idea of the human brain being able to be shaped into something that's more powerful than a computer, and so I did miss that in this movie as well, but I totally agree. I think it's so interesting, it's clear how Frank Herbert feels about religion, that it is at the end of the day, the most powerful people in the world have always used it as a tool, and that's terrifying, and it shouldn't be taken lightly.
Definitely not. Think about the potential of it as well, right? The ability to store information for generations, right? Mm-hmm. You can give someone, if you implant this kind of religion within this culture, right? They will hold on to information basically untouched for far longer than anything else, right? Stored in within their culture, within their brains. It's amazing. And then think about the Fremen traditions and stuff. Like all of that is built around them surviving in the desert, but it's all built on technology. You know, it's all the still suits and the thumpers and all of that is none of that is natural. That's all been built and maintained for generations and generations by these people that have feel like, they've lived off the land somehow for forever, but that's not really true. They're still augmented by technology. Oh, gosh, it really gets me going.
Who is it who says something to the effect of don't underestimate the power of faith or...
That was Irulan.
Yes, and I think that this movie shows that. The Fremen have been subjugated for, centuries, and they're getting, all these different houses, whoever shows up kind of just... forces them into hiding or overpowers them. But when they unite, when they have something that inspires them together, they're more powerful than any of them. And I think that's a really powerful thing to put out there, to say that their faith is what unites them. And that brings them, a chance to fight back. Whether that's going to lead them to a better place is yet to be seen. I've been picking up on hints that it's not. But
what do you mean? Paul's leading them to paradise. Didn't you hear him say that?
But again, that promise unites them in a way that they hadn't been united before.
Well, one of my favorite things about Dune is one of the main tentpole things of the lore is I think they're called thinking machines. There was a whole thing way back before the plot of the AI took over, basically, and so there was a whole war about outlawing thinking machines. That's why you have the Mentats, who are basically human computers. That's why you have the Navigators to fill in for computers. And so that's what you were saying, Joey, of just Frank Herbert was so fascinated by the power of the mind and his fear that other things would do the thinking for us. And I think towards the end of this movie, you see many of the Fremen. They've given up thinking and are acting on blind faith. You see that in Stilgar. Shani is trying to you know, give them sense, you know, telling them like this is all fake, but faith has taken over. They've stopped thinking. Now the faith, it's almost like they're programmed with the faith. And that's kind of what you, I think that's what fascinates me, Jay, from your perspective with the religious. It's just like when people, I mean, I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with religion, but when you let the religion do the thinking for you, that's when you find really, that's when trouble starts brewing.
Right. Yeah. I think it's just, I mean, it all comes back to, you know, one thing that I think is at the core of all this. And I think that Frank Herbert and obviously then Denis Villeneuve is trying to say is that, you know, the issue of power and humanity or just humanity in general is just, it's unsolvable, you know, like, you know, through tens of thousands of years or however long humanity has been around in the Dune universe. You know, you have the Bene Gesserit, you know, basically the Illuminati, who have been like working towards a solution for however long they've been around, also millennia probably. And they had it. It was right there. And then just because Duke Leto was a cool guy and a good dad, it all got backwards.
Damn it, we weren't accounting for good dads.
we're accounting for how attractive Oscar Isaac is.
There you go.
Could you guys imagine the Bene Gesserit flowchart for the Kwisatz Haderach?
Well, yeah. Speaking of complicated things, I feel like we're branching into a fractal conversation. So let's focus in a little bit. And I'm going to go back to what Jay said about Lord of the Rings. I also was thinking about Lord of the Rings while I was watching this, Jay, about how like watching Lord of the Rings feels and the kind of epicness of scope, I think, matches Dune in many ways, right? But from the fantasy side instead of the sci-fi side. And yet, Peter Jackson's stories or movies are I feel like, undeniable masterpieces. I wonder how you feel about contrasting that to Dune, especially since the thing that stands out most to me is just the amount of color that's available to you when you're trying to do a Lord of the Rings story versus a Dune story. What else, like, how would you compare and contrast those two?
Yeah, so this is what I was thinking about a lot, because I mean, Lord of the Rings is, I mean, incredible. I mean, it's, you know, it's like one of the best, like, that trilogy is one of the best things that's ever, you know, existed in cinema, you know. But the fact of the matter is that it is also pretty straightforward. I mean, despite the fact that it takes, thematically, it's straightforward. That's what I'll say. You know, because
right.
Like,
well, yeah, there's a very simple story of get the thing to the other place, and then there's a bunch of auxiliary things that are like related to it, which you have plenty of space to explore. Whereas Dune is like, well, you have to understand that this is part of this in order for this to be set up. You know, all the dominoes have to stack perfectly before you mm-hmm. can get to the point where you're like, oh, now I understand what's going on.
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah. And even, you know, like, I mean, Lord of the Rings is how you know who the bad guy is and you know who the good guys are. You know, that's pretty straightforward. And, you know, like, Frodo isn't summoning, you know, like, fulfilling any sort of prophecy, you know, set up by, you know, generations of Baggins before him to, like, make him, you know, like the most special boy in the universe, or right, you know, it's just good versus evil, right? And so I think that on a baseline is just super easy to glob onto, and to feel a part of it, and I think that it does that really well, because, like, you know, you could make it, you know, too simplistic, you know, because there could be you do feel the struggle that the characters go through, and they earn their heroic moments by their words and their deeds, and what they're willing to do for each other. But, you know, as opposed to Dune, you know, I mean, Paul, you know, you have this internal struggle that he's going through, but there's just so many big influences. There's so many, you know, like you said, esoteric, you know, big ideas that are happening here, mm-hmm. that it makes me think about the world, and it makes me think about, you know, like what's actually happening in the world and like what can be done about it. And I don't know. That's, and again, I think this might tie back to just where I am at, like, you know, like life-wise as well.
I think I understand what you're saying. Yeah. It's like there's no opportunity for ordinary people to have any sort of influence through their own bravery or courage or their whatever values they have, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Lord of the Rings feels like it's ordinary people attempting something extraordinary. This is extraordinary people attempting something also extraordinary. Well, and it feels a little harder to get into.
Well, I think too, Jay, I just feel like Lord of the Rings is very much a person making their own destiny, and Dune is people trapped by destiny, if that makes sense. We're comparing it to Lord of the Rings, but I mean, Dune is very much like Game of Thrones too, with all superficially with all the great houses and the scheming, but also that's a very gray show. There's no definitive good guy. So no, yeah. I think it's so interesting how Dune, and I think this is too, like, meta narratively, talking about the relationship between fantasy and sci-fi, because fantasy has always been more of like, you know, good guys and or traditionally, you know, saving the day, where sci-fi is much more analytical and not as morally, you know, definitive. So I feel like these are both epics in their respective genre, speculative genre, you know, clashing almost.
I think just to complete the collection of media that's always referenced when you talk about great media, I got Breaking Bad vibes from the fact that Paul is not a good guy, and there are people who are going to idolize Paul. I think I can add him to the pantheon of problematic male protagonists that are idolized for the wrong reason.
That's getting bigger and bigger every day. Also, the spice is blue, just like Walter White's meth.
Exactly. But not doing a meme. I think that that's an interesting thing to have. You know, it might make it so it's harder to identify with the character, but I think it's an interesting exploration that Paul doesn't do the right thing, or doesn't or maybe wants to do the right thing, but then for whatever reason succumbs to revenge, succumbs to his lust for power, succumbs to destiny. I think that makes him an interesting, complex character.
No, I love that comparison too, because you have these media that are about the you know, gaining of power and the destruction caused by it. But Breaking Bad is such on a micro scale. It's just a dude, you know, living in Albuquerque.
Yes, yeah.
When you have Paul dealing with power, but it's on a literal galactic scale, 10,000 years in the making. It's just. I think that's so interesting because it's like, These themes are so universal. It doesn't matter. You're dealing with the micro or the macro, your sci-fi or fantasy. It's still just like, it's just human experience.
It's one of the ways that I'm identifying with this film is Paul's relationship to a monogamous relationship, because when he is with Chani, they have that kind of stereotypical monogamous relationship you see in popular media, where they find each other, they're committed to each other, they grow in trust, and eventually reach a status of unity where they are one in the same. And to see Paul betray that, to me, again, not knowing that it was coming at all, I was shattered. I was like, no, yeah. Paul, how could you do this? And you know, I'm about to get married. I'm at a point in my life, you know, I'm doing premarital counseling. I'm being very I'm making a decision here to go down a path, and I'm choosing, you know, a monogamous relationship for the rest of my life, and knowing that removes the options to go down other paths, right? You have to choose. And so now I'm going to use that.
You can't be emperor anymore.
That's what I'm telling my fiance, is that, you know, I chose you instead of becoming the god emperor of the galaxy. So I'm serious about this relationship. You know, this is really what I want. Also, side note, my fiance's name is Liesl, and I've been calling her Liesl Al-Ghaib since we went and saw it yesterday.
if that's not in your vows, Benjamin, I'm super disappointed.
I'm gonna get all my groomsmen to go Liesl Al-Ghaib, like, all together.
you're gonna give her like the hooks, the sand writing hooks.
That's how we're gonna get to our honeymoon.
Okay, I want to jump down here a little bit and talk a little bit about the changes to Chani. which is in relation to what you were just referencing, Benjamin. This is a change, personally, I think, I really liked, because it really made the difference between, it really showed what I think Frank Herbert's intention was, which is not necessarily portrayed super clearly in the original text. And I really appreciate Chani as the vehicle for that. But Eli, how did you feel about these changes to Chani, making her more of a, giving her more of the narrative?
Oh my God, night and day. Like, I the book, I didn't fall in love with most of the characters in the book because it just felt so distant, and Chani just kind of felt like, oh, here's the love interest, you know, here's the, you know, the Dances right. with Wolves character that gets, you know, that is the in for Paul to assimilate. I think the movie did such a great job of making her her own person. I love the struggle she had of like loving Paul but hating the Lisan al Gaib, you know, because it's like, I love you, you know, Muad'Dib, Usul, whatever the five names Paul has, you know, because that's like, that's who.
Not calling him Paul for sure.
Yeah. Definitely calling him Paul. But no, she loved Paul, but, and she was frustrated. It just, you could tell she was just so wrought with like grief that it's essentially losing her lover to this prophecy that she knows was planted by a bunch of Illuminati nuns, which is just super frustrating.
Illuminati or Illuminashi.
But no, I think the movie, I think Villeneuve, especially compared to the first movie, because Chani in the first movie just is walking and like looking around and like, Paul. but here, seeing her do like badass things, being, you know, having her hurt emotionally, because that's another thing with like female characters and a lot of like action movies is that, yeah, they do the cool thing. All right. I mean, they're not really a full character, but I love seeing Chani just like in pain. Like you said, Benjamin, my heart was breaking when he was like, I love you as long as I breathe. And I knew what was coming. And I was like, no,
no, don't do it, Paul.
Yeah. But I think Villeneuve and credit Zendaya, she did a great job performing just the anger and the love and the, you know, disappointment and everything. It was such a great decision to have the last shot of the movie just have her face. Just, you could tell there's a lot there.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Jay?
Yeah, no, I mean I completely agree. I think that her actually being, you know, a part of the narrative and not some ghost that Paul is, you know, chasing, it you know, I think Benjamin mentioned it, you know, it's good payoff. You know, I think that finally we actually get to see this character, and, you know, it's understandable why, you know, Paul's, you know, sightseeing or future seeing, or, you know, why it focused so much on Chani. So I think that just like makes a lot of more sense, and it like brings it full circle. And I did enjoy that. I enjoyed it a lot. And I thought Zendaya's performance was technically excellent, you know, but, you know, again, and I didn't feel the same emotion at the end of the movie when Paul betrayed her, you know. I guess like maybe because I saw it coming, or like I don't know, I just didn't really care about their relationship all that much, despite the fact that like I knew like the performances I was seeing were very good, but maybe I just didn't buy into them. But I do appreciate that, you know, she isn't that she didn't just go along with it, right, as she, you know, as she does in the book. So, you know, I think that was a very good choice.
Yeah, I agree. I really do. It's like the last page of the book, where they talk to Chani about this, and it's one of my favorite lines from the book. But I'm happy to sacrifice that and to have Chani be a more fully formed character, just like you guys were saying. Yeah, and having her be the vehicle to... basically, she's just realizing that Paul's a monster before everybody else is, you know?
Yeah.
And I think just having that... having her be the vehicle for that is really powerful, especially like when this book has... You know, it's, in fact, Frank Herbert had this problem after the book came out. They put Paul on that problematic male antihero board that's in Benjamin's living room, and everybody's like, oh, Paul, like, you know, Paul's great, and that's part of the reason why he wrote Dune Messiah, was to kind of respond to that and be like, no, you guys missed the point. So to have Benu kind of take that interpretation and then run with it, I think is pretty brilliant, actually. And I appreciate Zendaya's like being that vehicle. I think she's wonderful.
This is what my friend after I was like, yeah, I needed time to digest the movie to think about it. He said, all right, at least tell me at what moment you went from I want to find my guerrilla warfare wife to oh no, we're not the good guys. And referring to Chani as his guerrilla warfare wife was one of my favorite things.
Well, they were blown up what it was called. There's a quadcopter thing.
That
is what love is about, isn't it?
Yeah. First date, blow up a few ornithopters.
Okay, let me back up here. Eli, what themes are present to you other than the ones we've already discussed, especially about like power and the corrupting nature of it?
Yeah, I was thinking every other theme I could mention maybe like feeds into power, but there is this feeling of, you know, predestiny, I think, is very, you know, ever present. Within the Dune series, if I can jump ahead, I want to. This quote I think is perfect for this discussion.
I see possible futures all at once, and in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through.
And that line just killed me when I was thinking about the quote from Jameis in the last movie, when Jameis tells, the mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience, a process that cannot be understood by stopping it. We must go with the flow of process. But Paul can't do that anymore. He sees all futures. He can't just go along with the flow because he knows where the flow is going to go. You know?
Right.
So it's just so tragic to me that this beautiful quote Paul can't experience anymore because of his situation, being a prophesized hero, a messiah. And it just sucks. Like the idea of, I've always been interested in free will as a narrative, and I'm very much on the pro free will boat because I think that's more engaging.
You like free will? You want to keep free will?
I'm just going to come out and say it, guys. I think free will is pretty rad. But seriously, though, that sucks when you...
He was determined to say that. He could not say that.
I knew he was going to say that.
No, it's a simulation. No. I do like free will, but it also hurts when I see a character get their free will taken away from them. And you know, whether it be like imprisonment or this, like Paul, he's the prophet. He sees all futures. Whatever free will he has can't exist anymore because he knows, like, he sees what he's going to do. And it's just a mind, like, you know, cluster that you can't get rid of.
Yeah, I think the predestination stuff, I think, is endlessly fascinating. The fact that he can see where he's going and what's going to happen, and he does it anyway, right? That makes you really question everything, right? Is he doing it because of that? Is he doing it despite that? Does he think he can change it, you know? Or does he think he has no choice? All these other people are pushing him towards something, but they don't understand the same thing that he does, but he does it anyway. It's all very, it's all fascinating, I think. And I think it's another part of this human experience, like where you know where you're going to end up and you can't stop it, right? No amount of awareness can stop you from ending up on the path that you were on. And it's a, you like to think that if you saw the future, you could change it, but it's Dune kind of throws into the question of whether that's even possible. And I think that's a very heady thing to think about. I think it's hard to grapple with. It makes you really wonder about free will, for sure, and it makes you wonder what the is this actually true, or is this just a story? I think that it's something that comes up often in philosophy, and the fact that it's in this story, I think, makes it it proves again that Dune is really tapped into these feelings that I think a lot of people often feel and often grapple with.
Yeah, and if I could mention one more time, I'm going to hark on this because it's one of my favorite movies, and I like talking about it, so I'm going to do it, but I want to compare it to another media, Lawrence of Arabia, because everything we're talking about is present in Lawrence of Arabia too, besides the superficial comparisons. You know, we see a character assimilate into another culture, love being part of that culture, watch his ascension into that culture, and watch power degrade his love of the culture. But Lawrence, within Lawrence of Arabia, also deals with his own predestination, where, you know, he's part of the English army. Like, this is all, he's eventually going to go back to England, but he clearly doesn't want to. And you watch him just suffer at the fate that it's just like, I want to stay here. I want to stay in Arabia. But it's like, no, you have to go back to England. And then eventually, you know, when he goes back to England, he dies. So, yeah, I will always plug Lawrence Arabia. I love that movie. And I love, now that I've seen Dune Part 2, I think it's just so cool seeing all the, like, the threads being, you know, attached in more ways than one.
I'm also going to take this opportunity to shout out probably my favorite scene from the movie, which is what I'm calling Tears from a Desert Flower, when Chani cries and... waste water for the dead, right? She puts her tears in Powell's mouth and awakens him, and it's to fulfill a prophecy that she does not believe in. I thought that was so amazing. It's just the amount of manipulation and all this stuff that was going into it, and how she knew what they were trying to do or have her do, and she did it anyway, despite like her knowing better, because she loved Paul so much. It was all just like tied together in this crazy web. And I thought that was really, really incredible. That is one of my favorite scenes I've seen in a long time in a movie.
I love it because it's the inversion of, like, you know, oh, the tears will bring the character back from the dead, and it literally does, but it's not sweet. It's like, oh god.
I love that line too, the you may not believe in the prophecy, but you're part of it. I thought it was really cool. Mm-hmm. But just going back to the free will thing, let's say that Paul does have ultimate free will and he actually does want to end up being a good guy. At what point does Paul stop helping the Fremen against their oppressors and still end up being a good guy? Because I feel like they do a really good job of justifying his next moves leading up to him drinking the water of life. And then after he has drank the water of life, to me, Paul Atreides is dead. And now we have new superpower, you know, the future seer, you know.
God boy.
Kwasek Haderach, incoming kind of guy. So, what would you say to that? How would you make it so that Paul, while still, you know, saving his own skin and not just dying to the Harkonnens, how does he be a good guy?
It's a tough situation. I mean, for sure, right? The Fremen live in a very harsh environment, not just because of the desert, but because of the people that rule over Arrakis, right? So one way or another, that has to be dealt with. Paul sees a future that leads to him being the emperor, but it's not necessarily the only thing that's possible. I don't know.
Well, I think it lends itself more towards this view of conflicts being more gray than I think a lot of people portray them to be. A lot of times, especially when you have your news source of choice, things are portrayed in very black and white. This is what the good people are doing. This is what the bad people are doing. Everything the good people are doing is good. Everything the bad people are doing is bad. And, you know, that's the only way to see it. And I think Dune gives you a situation where you're like, who's good, who's bad? You know, some of these people think they're doing the right thing. Maybe they're doing the right thing by, like, the end. They're, like, looking at it as, like, the ends justify the means. It's difficult to actually have a situation in reality where it's the good side is wholly good.
Well, also, part of the issue, you're talking about what would be good for the Fremen. In a weird way, the Fremen's dream is to make Arrakis like an oasis world with water and trees and everything. But if they did that, there's no more spice. And so it's like this dream world can't exist. This dream world can't coexist with the galaxy we are in, which is just so tragic. And so maybe to answer your question, maybe this Paul needs to go on this jihad to do what's best for the Fremen, because their dream is not compatible with the universe. And like you were saying, Joey, like the Fremen just can't live by themselves because their planet is so important. No other planet can make this essential resource. And hey, if we look at it outside the movie, what other desert location is home to a lot of a resource that is needed for for transportation purposes, you know?
Right. Maybe people just need to switch to a, you know, renewable fuel source and not spice. Do something they have on their own home world. Maybe give up interplanetary travel. Who knows?
I think this is why I love this story so much. It's so, and why I love sci-fi in general is like there's so much tied up to it. Dune does such a great job of touching on all these subjects. I mean, it was originally written as like an environmentalist story as well back you know in the 60s and 70s, which is pretty amazing. And it's I think it still holds so much water. Pun intended today.
wait, before we get to it, Benjamin, I have to ask, because this is kind of pertinent. Did you get to the chapter in Dune where Liet Kynes is just like talking to himself?
I don't think so. I just got to Kynes, and Kynes is a man. You know, oh, that's different in the movie.
Yeah, there's a scene where Kynes, because I forget his term in the story, he's a
ecologist or... Yeah, but
yes, right. Yes.
Yeah, something to
effect. It's like the Dune version of an ecologist, yeah. But yeah, he just spends the entire chapter talking about how Dune, like as Arrakis, works, and it's just so fascinating. So I'm very curious. You know, we could talk about all we want about faith and power and everything, but Frank Herbert wrote the book because he did some acid and went to the dunes in Oregon. You know, there's a love of environment in this story that I think is. Mm-hmm. Almost more important than all the like human elements to it, you know, as much as, you know, we can battle, you know, over power and have all these great houses at war. I mean, still planets are just planets. Environment is environment. Arrakis will still live on regardless of how much who's, you know, living there and getting all the spice.
Worms or no worms. okay. I'm going to skip down to this last question here. So having just watched part 2, part 3 is not yet in development. They're still working on a script, but Denis Villeneuve said that he would love to make it part 3 if the opportunity came about. Would you guys be on board for more Dune? Eli?
If Villeneuve is operating the train, I'm on board, baby. Like, I like what he's doing. It's just, I just like when creators have a clear vision of what they want to do, and I think Villeneuve understands. I mean, you read interviews with the guy, and this guy apparently, like, went to bed holding a copy of Dune in his arms. Like, this is his baby. And so, yeah, at this point, I'm just fine. Whatever he wants to do with the story, I'm going to follow it. I would be much more apprehensive if they gave a different, like, I heard there's a Dune TV show in the works, and that's, we'll see about that. But yeah, no, if it's Villeneuve making these movies, I'll keep seeing them because they're just so great.
Jay, you were a little more sour on part 2. Do you think you'll come back for part 3?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I'll for sure. And because these movies are optimally seen in the theater as well, I'll for sure go back to the theater to see the part 3 should it come to exist as well. I'm still very much on the Dune train. And I'll look forward to part 3 should it arrive. Yeah, for sure.
What about you, Benjamin?
Oh, definitely. This is a situation where as soon as part 2 is done, it's like, now I'm more invested in Dune now than I ever have been. Give me more Dune, which actually leads into what I've been doing since seeing the second movie, which is reading the book. First thing I did when I got home was I talked to one of my friends who's big on Dune, has been telling me to read Dune for years. He was like, you got to read Dune now. And I was like, all right, you're right. And I was like, with you as my witness, you know, as is written, I'm going to read Dune. And I know that, like, even you guys said in our first episode that it is actually pretty dense, you know, that especially the very beginning. But my word of encouragement to anyone listening to this podcast that is wants to consume more Dune, now is the perfect time to read the book, because it's like reading it with cheat codes. You're going to understand all the jargon terms. You're going to have a really good basis of what, you know, everything looks like. You're going to picture Oscar Isaac and all the other actors when you're thinking about these scenes. And it's a really easy to read book once you get past kind of the, in universe terminology and the way things work. Plus, there's so much more in there that is so interesting that obviously the movie can't have, because the movie can't be 1,000 hours long. So since I saw Dune Part 2, all I've wanted to do is spend more time in the Dune universe. And the book is exactly, it's satisfying that need. So that to anybody out there, now is the time. Go ahead and read Dune if you haven't. It's really nice to have this primer to go off of first so that you can easily get into the book.
Okay, before we go to a break, is anything else you guys wanted to talk about in our overall section?
More free will.
Free will. I knew he was going
to
say that.
Speaking of free will, I don't want to talk about this anymore.
One last point I want to say, like, Dune is a very, you know, it takes itself very seriously. So I appreciate all the little drops of comedy and reprieve that Villeneuve put in the movie. Like, Stilgar is so funny.
Yes.
Like, he's the Mahdi. The Mahdi is too humble to say he's the Mahdi. I was dying.
Yeah, I awesome. Love that as well. Okay, well, that is going to bring us to our break. But don't go anywhere, because when we return, we're going to discuss cool Easter eggs and go over some quotable moments. We'll be right back. Playoff time, baby. Game, snacks. I mean, what else can you ask for?
Hey, pass me an Affable Chat Cola.
I mean, can you drink any louder?
That's how I drink.
Loud like that?
I drink loud. I like to enjoy it.
Toss me that bag of Affable Chat chips.
Ugh, can you eat any louder?
It's normal to eat loud. Drinking loud makes no sense.
Whoa, it's famous movie star Arnold Schwarzenegger. Cool.
Guess what, guys? I got tickets to the big game. Let's go.
No way. The roads are too tough for us to get to the game. We're not going. I'm gonna go grab some chips and drinks. Do not leave.
Don't worry. I can get us to the game in my 2023 midsize luxury Affable Chat brand pickup truck.
All right.
Are you kidding me?
Let me know if you can see me in the crowd on TV.
Hey, I'm coming after you. After I finish eating these chips.
To find out what happens next, visit affablechat.com.
And we're back with Jay and Eli from the Super Bracket Bros. And we're talking about cool Easter eggs for Dune Part 2. Eli, what have you got for us?
As Jay mentioned earlier, very tragically, Denny Villeneuve says he's not releasing any deleted scenes. His quotes were very interesting when he's talking about it, though. He says, quote, "I'm a strong believer that when it's not in the movie, it's dead. I kill darlings. It's very painful for me." But the thing that, like, that the quote that really interests me is he says, quote, "I'm very, I think, severe in the editing room. I'm not thinking about my ego. I'm thinking about the movie." And it's so cool. You know, he talks so much about reverence to Dune that he is so committed to, like, distancing himself from the project. This is to him what's important for the story and not for us, you know, our lizard brain. I want more fight scenes, you know. but you know,
what is it that you said last time? More just shots of the desert.
No, yeah, just like, I want 10-minute ASMR of just the little kangaroo mouse wiping its ears. But it's just interesting that I think universally we had the same cons of like, why not more of this? Why not more of this? But the person in charge of everything is like, no. No more. This is what is needed. And I'm always interested in seeing directors talk about their projects because they have such a different perspective that, yeah, clearly for us, you should have added more. And he's like, no, I did exactly what needed to be done. And it's just that dissonance between what we think was needed, what he thought was needed, is just very fascinating to me.
Yeah.
I was reading some interviews with him too, and it seems like he didn't have any sort of constraint on time. Like, it wasn't like the studio was telling him he needed to cut all this stuff out, right? He was allowed to make it as long as he wanted to, and this is the length that he decided was best. So I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's why you have the book. You know, if you want to have the stuff from all the stuff from the book, go read the book. You know, there's all these ways that this movie could have been made that are closer to the book, but make it a bad movie. But there is a narrow path where you could be close to the book, but make a movie that's
awesome. Hey.
That's very funny.
Yeah. I agree with them. You know, I always respect the creator, whether it be an author, musician, director. I think their vision is more important than what me, you know, wants. But Man, come on.
You just gotta, you just wait. Just wait him out. You know, he's gonna die eventually. Warner Brothers could do whatever they want.
What's so funny is that this is like a reverse Snyder cut situation. It's like we can't get the Villeneuve cut, but we Okay, so my next trivia is just super neat trivia I thought was cool, but I want to credit David and Jesse Peterson. They are the Conlangers. If you don't know that term, it's constructive language, and Conlangers are people who make languages. So J.R.R. Tolkien, probably the most famous Conlanger who's ever existed. And so David and Jesse Peterson made the Fremen language called Chakabza. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But it was cool how they were talking about combining, because obviously it's Arabic themed, but they were like putting together different, French and Spanish terms and kind of just shoving it together to make something that works. And they talked about, David specifically talked about going into Dune the book, looking at the glossary and building the language off from there. Because I love listening to the Fremen language in the movie. I thought that was so cool. And you probably have also heard David's work before, because he's credited for creating the Dothraki language from Game of Thrones. And it's just cool that he was talking about that. He also apparently did High Valyrian, which you can read on Duolingo. It's another language from Game of Thrones. So yeah, if you want to learn some High Valyrian, go ahead. But that the interview, I would definitely look up his interview with IndieWire, because he talks about Conlangers like in film, how some Conlangers built entire languages and movies were just like, nah, we're not gonna include it. And it's just so much work is lost, and he's like so thankful that the modern film scene is so much more open to having these constructive languages exist in perpetuity versus being lost to time. So very interesting. I love constructed languages. I think it's so neat learning about them. So yeah, I love David and Jesse Peterson. My hat's off to you for creating such a cool language.
That's really amazing. I mean, just imagine, like, you call up a guy and you're like, I need a new language.
Well, he talked about, because, like, when you're making language, you just don't make a word that says hello. You come up with a phrase that is a greeting that you shorten, you know? And I didn't even think about that, but yeah, all of your greetings in different languages, nobody just says hi there, you know.
Interesting. Yeah, I was wondering if it was just like a reskinned version of like another language, but no, it's like more complicated than that. It's really like a from the bottom up. That's crazy.
Yeah,
no, well, it's just like the moments in the movie where Paul is explaining Caladan to Shani, right? And they probably don't have a word for swimming. Doesn't exist.
You submerge in water. She's like, no, you can't.
impossible.
But no, I encourage everybody to not just look up that David Peterson interview with IndieWire, but just look up Conlangers just in your free time. It's such a fascinating field of etymology. I'm a big etymology nerd, so that stuff was so interesting to me. My last trivia goes back to Villeneuve, and I watched. He did an interview with Cinefex talking about his favorite shot from each of the movies he's directed. And it is so fascinating listening to what his favorite shots were, because a lot of them weren't in like the big shots that you anticipated. A lot of his favorite shots were of people just like sitting down and staring at something. His favorite shot in Blade Runner 2049 was Ryan Gosling's character asleep in the car. And it's like, because to him, that was the moment you connect with him. That's the small moment that you recognize him as a human being. It's just so cool hearing a film director say like, oh, all the action stuff, yeah, that's whatever. But this scene of a guy sleeping in a car, that's the good stuff. And so I want to mention his favorite shots from Dune and Dune Part 2 in Dune Part 1. It's when Paul first steps foot on Arrakis. It's literally a shot of his feet walking, and then he kneels down and touches the sand with his hand. And he goes on saying how there's such a, quote, there's something so honest about foots and hands in a way that's absolutely pure. It's a direct relationship with reality. Wow. What? That's so interesting. And like, I studied film. I did film studies in college. So this stuff is just so fascinating to me, how I listened to a director, Freddie Wong of Rocket Jump. He talked about he's not interested in big special effects anymore. The shots he loves are the little like cuts and the little moments of perspective shifts. And it's so cool that Villeneuve brought that to such a massive project as Dune. But the thing you're all probably wondering, what's his favorite shot from Dune Part 2? It is the same, my favorite shot, when Paul rides the sandworm. Specifically, he makes the shot where Paul is struggling to stand up, and when he finally stands up, it's him like symbolizing he's now joined the Fremen. Now he's a man. And I think that's so cool that, you know, it was not all the action shots. It wasn't the war scenes. It wasn't any of the, you know, us being like, oh, that's so cool. It's just the shot of him standing up. And I think that's so cool. It's such an interesting film director perspective.
Chills.
Yeah, I think it was his wife who worked on the, what was called the worm unit, right? They were making they were the ones that were in charge of the effects for the worm. They like practiced riding the worms and stuff and taught the actors how to do it. Which was so they were. He said like I'm in debt to the worm unit. If they hadn't pulled that off, I would still be making the movie. So.
No. In the interview, he said, "I'm not going to tell you how I did it because I want the magic to still be there." But he did say, "I will reveal to you. I got a pretty small sandworm, so I didn't hurt Timothy." He just seems like an interesting. Denis Villeneuve seems like an interesting guy. I would love to just pick his brain.
I have one fun Easter egg here, which is the video for Weapon of Choice by Fatboy Slim. It's a very famous music video directed by Spike Jonze, and it features Christopher Walken. And he is, if you've never seen it, it's like it comes up every year, it goes viral on the internet like every year, because someone new has discovered it. Eternal September. He's sitting there in like some hotel lobby like by himself, and then he starts dancing, and then eventually he starts like flying through the lobby and stuff. It's pretty cool. Anyway, there's a line in the song that says, "Walk without rhythm, and you won't attract the worm." Which is, of course, a direct reference to Dune. So Christopher Walken coming back to do his second Dune appearance in Dune Part 2.
We can only imagine
rhythm.
We can only imagine that this music video is the way the Emperor or initially took hold of the galaxy, is by impressing everybody with these moves.
Went viral.
That'd be a real statement.
You walk without rhythm and you won't attract the worm.
Subscribe to the Emperor.
hit that notification bell.
We really are doomed if the Emperor is Mr. Beast or some YouTube show, a star.
I put this noble house on a desert planet. Okay, so my cool Easter egg is that Stellan Skarsgård, his body makeup took 8 hours to apply and 2 hours to remove every day of shooting. And apparently he didn't drink anything, and he took Imodium pills in order to avoid having to go to the bathroom. So just complete insanity, honestly, to bring about his character.
Wow. I always love learning about the logistical things that go into making a movie, because we just watch it and like, yeah, that was cool. But now it's just like, oh man, that guy.
I know. This is cruel and unusual. Like,
well, apparently people were passing out from like heat stroke in the audience during the Fade Ross's knife fight scene. It was really, really hot when they were doing it. And
yeah, because I was reading about that scene as well, and apparently Austin Butler needed hair for the next movie he was filmed after Dune 2, so he was in a bald cap the entire time. So so like he and like is in all black all the time, and so like he and yeah that whole Coliseum scene, like it was like 110 degrees, like it was just like awful conditions, and I'm just like, how often are they running out there and like blotting sweat off this guy for him to look like this during the scene? Like, it's just absolute insanity. Man,
yeah, really cool. Okay,
all right, so let's move on to our quotable moments, and Eli, do you want to preface this with anything?
Sure. So I pulled this quote. conveniently it was in a trailer so we can play it now without resorting to illegal means. but no, this is a scene. This is early in the movie when Paul is talking to Chani and they kind of have their meet cute and start to develop their relationship.
I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Oh, it's just so tragic because it's like he wants to be equal. He wants to be part of the Fremen, to be part of this community that he's joined, but he can't. He is the Lisan al-Ghaib, you know, as is written. He can't escape his fate. And we talked about all the predestination stuff earlier. And this quote is very much like, I want to be this, but circumstances don't let me be this. And I want to mention a quote. I learned this quote from George R. R. Martin, but he's actually quoting William Faulkner. The quote is, The only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. And this quote, I think, perfectly demonstrates that, because Paul, you know, his heart wants to be with the Fremen, but he knows to save the Fremen, he has to embrace this destiny that tears him away. You know, clearly, like, he wants, you know, I'll love you as long as I breathe. Hey, Princess Irulan, let me take you as my bride, because that's, like, the best situation. And you just tell, like, how much in pain he is. So it's cool that, you know, it's a quote by William Faulkner, mentioned by George R. R. Martin, and that's what we were talking about with these themes, you know, transcending genre, transcending time even, and just being applicable to so much, you know, and ultimately when we write stories and read stories, we are interested in the human heart trying to circumvent difficult circumstances, and Dune especially is that.
Yeah, I think this is really beautiful. I love the way you've framed this, Eli. I also want to point out that this is the second movie we've done in the podcast where Timothy Chalamet picks Florence Pugh over his other love interest.
I saw that. Yeah. But it was not his first choice. I love Letterboxd as a treasure. I love
all right. And this other quote, Eli, is there anything you want to say before you play this one?
So this is the very first thing you hear in the movie, like before the movie even starts, you hear it in a Sardaukar beatboxing voice. Now, we talked about this earlier, but I just like the themes of power are so important with this movie. And yeah, if you control the spice, you control everything. You people bend at the knee to who has this vital resource that's needed, and whoever controls that resource is so important. And I love that this line is delivered like the screen, like, yeah, it just kind of freaked me out too. I was like watching previews and it's like the screen turns black and you just hear like this thing just yell at you. And it sets the mood. I love to bring out, you know, my snotty film studies terminology. I love it's non-diegetic. Non-diegetic means not happening in the movie. So this voice is not happening in the Dune universe, but it's directly targeted towards you, the audience, almost like priming you to be like, whatever you take from this movie, just don't assume it's in the movie in isolate. Like, it is. Yeah. These are real world themes, even if it's taking place in a galaxy very, very far away and ahead of its time.
It definitely gets you in the mood for some epic sci-fi insanity. So.
Well, it's interesting too, because the last movie started off with the Sardaukar voice yelling at you, but it was dreams are messages from the deep. And so I'm interested in how those two quotes correlate. And then in the third movie, how what we're going to get yelled at in that one. Also, can I just say, like, I'm happy we got this quote, because I missed that Sardaukar beatboxing. That was
Where was that?
That was a
of that.
Yeah, I just, even if it's an unnecessary scene of a bunch of Sardaukar just bumbling around, I don't care. I want more of it.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, that is it for our quotable moments, and that's going to bring us to a close for our discussion on Dune Part 2. As we do at the end of every episode of Affable Chat, we'll now deliver our ratings, and we'll start with Jay. What rating do you want to give to this film?
I give this movie one Paul Atreides, the most special boy with the biggest brain and a hole where his heart is supposed to be.
All right, well, let's go over to Eli. What rating do you want to give this film?
I give Dune Part 2 10 desert mice who are unaware there is an intergalactic jihad happening in their name. Out of 10.
All right, Joey, what's your rating?
I give this movie some chicken tendies with some famous herbs and spice melange on them.
Delicious. And finally, my rating, I give this movie a real-life still suit that you can wear while you watch it in the theater so you don't have to miss any of the movie when you need to go to the bathroom.
I'm surprised you went through this whole review not mentioning that popcorn bucket.
I know.
Yeah. Well,
now we have.
We've done it.
We're now like every other movie review podcast episode.
Made it
about
almost right to the end, Eli. Yeah.
The real I had a vision. Of this film.
I had a vision. I needed to be said. I know the narrow path. I needed to say it.
As it is written.
All right. Well, there you have it. Dune Part 2. We brought the Super Bracket Brothers back. I think you guys are our resident Dune heads. So when you're not guesting on our podcast, where can the people find you guys?
Oh, the people can find us wherever they find affable chat. So it's going to be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc., and everything in between. But come over to Super Bracket Bros, where we pit fictional characters from different universes against each other in a tournament to see just who is the best of the best. Right now, we are in the middle of a very special season of Super Bracket Bros, where instead of just theorizing who would win in a fight, we are playing it out via a system called GURPS. It is a tabletop role-playing game, and we are pitting our guests against each other as they pilot some of their favorite characters. Benjamin and Joey are both on this season, both piloting video game characters, of course, because they're movie podcasters. And it has been a lot of fun so far. It is taking me a little bit to edit and put these episodes together. So the release schedule is a little spotty, but at the time of this recording, there should be 3 or 4 episodes out. It should be the entire first round of the tournament. And then the back half will be coming your way soon. But that's what's going on for season 6 of Super Bracket Bros. You can find us and follow us on Instagram or Facebook. But the best way to get in touch is going to be joining our Discord. The Super Bracket Bros Discord is a great place to hang out and let us know what you think of the show. Benjamin, Joey, thank you guys so much for having us back on to talk Dune Part 2. This was a lot of fun, and honestly, I think by the end of this, I think I enjoy the movie a little bit more than I did going into this recording.
As is written. As is written.
Yeah. We got it. He's embraced his
destiny. Lisa Nagai, the one who enjoys.
If anyone listening has not listened to the Super Bracket Bros, the amount of work Jay has put into this season is absolutely incredible. Hours and hours of recording, editing, and preparation. It's something incredible. So definitely check it out, and especially the ones that me and Benjamin are part of, especially the one where we fight each other.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, well, thanks again for joining us, Super Bracket Brothers. We always enjoy having you guys on Affable Chat. Joey, what's next on our podcast?
Next, we are doing Blade.
Yes, I've never seen Blade. I don't know anything. Blade's iconic, and I am totally, that's a blind spot for me. So I'm excited to get into Blade.
You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Afflechat.com is your new favorite website on the internet. There you can find the latest from us and all of our social media accounts, especially Instagram, which is at Afflechat. And you can send us emails at our email address, afflechat@gmail.com.
If you like this episode, then tell a friend about it. All you have to say is, I must consider. Considering is the mind killer. Considering is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my considering. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. When the considering has gone, there will be nothing. Only listening to Affable Chat will remain.
Well said. That's
Jay, I suddenly have to listen to Affable Chat. I don't know why.
I need to leave this recording right now so I can go listen to Affable Chat.
That's going to do it for this episode. For Affable Chat, I'm Benjamin.
And I'm Joey.
Thanks for listening.